Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When I die, I think I want to come back as Ben Bernanke, because the guy doesn't even have to actually say anything and people start jumping. Case in point, today's troubles with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. All it took was a hint of a rumor that the Fed was going to ride to their rescue and things turned around. Until they turned it down again. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here. Today is the 11th of July. We have made it to another Friday, gang. But it kind of feels like we made it by the skin of our teeth. Maybe it's a good thing the markets are closed for the next 2 days because everybody's going to need some time to catch their breath. The basics of the story you know already, I think, that the government-backed mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have seen better days. Even before the opening bell rang this morning, things had taken a turn for the worse, and maybe that's why everybody grabbed on to the rumors that the Fed chairman was going to help out. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon is here to make a smart hire, Bob.
Hey, Kai, I hope so.
Yeah, right, me too. Once again, anyway, on the face of it, Ben Bernanke to the rescue here.
Well, maybe. If the government's trying to shore up confidence in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, though, they're not sending a very clear signal as yet. This afternoon, there were reports that the Fed is preparing to open its emergency lending window to make sure that those mortgage giants have adequate cash flow. But then soon after, a Fed spokesman denied that. And, you know, it's just these kind of conflicting signals that are what created this real crisis overnight. Investors went to bed with a reassurance from the top regulator of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that they both remain adequately capitalized and have large liquidity pools. Well, they woke up this morning to a story in the New York Times that the White House might put one or both of these companies under the control of a conservator. That would be a party or an institution that would then have the authority to make sweeping changes in the way they do business.
Okay, but help me understand why Wall Street gets so spooked by that.
Well, if you're an investor who holds Fannie or Freddie's stock, you're probably going to choke on your morning toast when you open up the paper and you read this paragraph. Under a conservatorship, the shares of Fannie and Freddie would be worth little or nothing. And that's why their shares went into free fall and lost half their value at one point today.
But then there were these reports mid-afternoon that Bernanke had met with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and said, in essence, we have this discount window, a ready source of cash. Come get it if you need it.
Followed immediately by that official denial that any decision has been made. Seems the government is wrestling with how to deal with this crisis. There is intense pressure, though, to take swift action of some sort.
If these guys, though, are just too big to fail, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, trillions of dollars of debt, huge impact on the mortgage market, how far is the government prepared to go then to bail them out?
Well, bailout may be the wrong word here if we're talking a full-scale bailout. That would really amount to the nuclear option in this case. Figure it this way. We're talking about companies that own or stand behind $5 trillion worth of outstanding debt. Well, the entire national debt is around $9.5 trillion, so we'd be adding half again as much to that overnight. Just really unlikely to happen.
You mentioned this became a crisis overnight from yesterday into today. It's not possible that nobody saw this coming.
It's actually been building for months now. All these big financial institutions have been struggling to pump in more cash to make up for what they've lost with all these outstanding loans going bad. In the case of Fannie and Freddie, Congress set them up and gave them very special treatment. They've enjoyed AAA credit ratings because of this implied or inferred bulletproof guarantee from the government. And they haven't really even had to maintain the piggy bank that most banks are required to for a rainy day. Now, let me remind you, this is not something that's just suddenly been discovered. Here's a familiar your voice from the past, Kai. This is Alan Greenspan. He was warning Congress about this very worry back when he was Fed chairman in 2004.
Unlike many well-capitalized savings and loans and commercial banks, Fannie and Freddie have chosen not to manage that risk by holding greater capital.
Now, up to now, they've had no problem going to Wall Street with hat in hand, but that option seemed to be foreclosed on them.
Nice to hear Greenspan's voice, wasn't it? You
yeah.
know, just a blast from the
just
past.
Bring him back.
This whole thing, this potential for a meltdown, government bailout, everybody jumping around like the world's coming to an end, It has vague memories of Bear Stearns.
It sure does. It's something of a self-fulfilling prophecy here. The fundamentals are good, they say, but then the crisis of confidence can erode all of those fundamentals.
And how busy do you think all these regulators and everybody are going to be this weekend on the phone trying to stop something bad from happening Monday?
I think the phone lines are still going to be buzzing all weekend long.
Marketplace's Bob Moon. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Kai.
When you consider that between them, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have their hands in 70% of all the mortgages in this country, this story gets really personal really fast. Whether there's a bailout or a conservatorship or nothing, what does it all mean for mortgage holders or those who'd like one? Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports on that from Washington.
First of all, if you have a mortgage, even if it's underwritten by Fannie or Freddie, don't panic, says the Brookings Institution's Douglas Elmendorf.
If you have a mortgage already and don't need a new one, and don't own shares in Fannie or Freddie, then you don't need to give any attention to what's going on.
But if you're planning to be in the market for a mortgage anytime soon, listen up. Fannie and Freddie borrow money in the bond markets to buy mortgages from lenders. Because of the implicit guarantee that they're backed by the U.S. government, Fannie and Freddie can borrow at very low interest rates. But the housing collapse and the run on foreclosures has undermined the financial market's confidence in the two companies that underwrite half the nation's mortgages. The result will be higher mortgage interest rates, says Alan Mendelowitz, a member of the Federal Housing Finance Board.
If Fannie and Freddie have to pay more to borrow money, it means mortgage is going to cost more.
And that's not good news for the struggling housing industry, says Douglas Elmendorf.
Any difficulty in getting mortgages pushes down the demand for housing. And that lowers housing construction still further, and it leaves more houses unsold on the market, and it further pushes down the price of houses.
But if the government steps in and gives Fannie and Freddie a steady source of cheap money, the lower cost of borrowing would be passed on to future home buyers. And that could prove necessary now that the growing number of mortgage defaults have made private lenders extremely skittish. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
If you think it was just Fannie and Freddie that brought the markets lower today, not so fast. We'll have the details and the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. We all know global warming is a touchy political subject in Washington. I'm not sure we knew exactly how touchy, though. It took the Environmental Protection Agency almost 1,000 pages today to say it's not going to decide what to do about greenhouse gas emissions, even though the Supreme Court ruled last year that the government does indeed have the authority to impose new regulations. From Washington Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports on what the EPA is going to do instead.
The Supreme Court decision put pressure on the EPA to use the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. The EPA did put forth some options for cutting emissions today, but the agency's administrator, Stephen Johnson, said the Clean Air Act wasn't the right tool for that, and he said he wasn't going to rush into anything. Johnson says the agency has decided to spend months hearing from the public on what he called an unprecedented expansion of EPA authority.
There can be profound consequences across all sectors of our economy and every individual living in their homes or where they work or driving cars.
But environmentalists say today's document dump was a stall tactic.
The Bush administration essentially is flipping the bird to the Supreme Court.
Frank O'Donnell is president of Clean Air Watch.
The Bush administration essentially is telling the Supreme Court, we're just going to study the issue a lot longer.
But Bill Kovacs of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce relishes the chance to comment on the EPA documents released today. He describes them as a roadmap to economic turmoil.
Almost every aspect of the economy would be regulated. We're talking about literally over time trillions of dollars of new regulations.
But none of those proposed regulations will be put into effect before President Bush leaves office. The president's successor will have to decide what to do about regulating emissions. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Peace seems to have broken out in St. Louis. There are reports today, so far not confirmed by either of the companies, that Anheuser-Busch is going to accept InBev's takeover this weekend. Budweiser is not going to come cheap for the Belgian brewer. It's had to bump its offering $5 a share, puts the total value of the deal at almost $50 billion. Federal Communications Commission Chairman Kevin Martin is peeved at Comcast. He wants the company formally reprimanded for improperly blocking some of its internet users. If we were all technology geeks, I'd roll out the phrase network neutrality right about here, and you'd all know exactly what I mean. I'm certainly not up on the latest tech talk, though, so I'll frame it this way for you. There's been a debate brewing about whether or not internet users and the applications they use should all be treated equally. And Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports this case could turn into a test of the government's power to do anything about it.
Comcast is in trouble for slowing down users of the popular file-sharing program BitTorrent. Comcast says when a user is uploading or downloading, a slight interruption won't hurt, the way it would if a user was, say, streaming a video. And we all know how annoying that can be. Well, the FCC's policy is that internet service providers can regulate traffic as long as it's, quote, reasonable network management. And Comcast Joe Waz says that's what the company does.
We, like all ISPs, manage our network, and we've sought to do so reasonably.
But Waz also says Comcast is not bound by the FCC's policy because it's not officially a rule. Craig Aaron is with the organization Free Press, which brought the Comcast complaint in the first place. He says if ISPs can target certain programs like BitTorrent, what's to stop them from restricting access to, say, certain websites down the road?
We need to protect these baseline protections like net neutrality to make sure that in the future the internet continues to prosper.
Richard Bennett is a network architect who's followed the issue closely for years, but he's on the fence about net neutrality.
I like it in concept, but in practice it's very difficult to enforce through specific regulations.
Still, he says it's long past time for the government to come up with clear rules because users are demanding more bandwidth every day.
Today's bandwidth hog is tomorrow's mainstream user.
The FCC will vote on whether to reprimand Comcast at a meeting August 1st. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
A dinner out with friends is supposed to be relaxing, right? Not painful. And what are the topics you're supposed to stay away from again? Politics and religion. Economics, too, it seems, because commentator and economist Dan Ariely says nickel and diming to split the check isn't worth the hassle.
When the server drops off the check at the end of the meal, people often scramble to figure out the norms for payment. Do we each pay for what we ordered? Do we split the bill evenly, even if John had that extra glass of wine and the creme brulee? Findings from behavioral economics tell us that one person should pay the entire bill and that the person paying should alternate over time. When we pay any amount of money, we feel some psychological pain. We call this the pain of paying. This is the unpleasantness that is associated with forking over our hard-earned cash. But it also turns out that this pain does not increase linearly with the cost of the meal. This means that when we double the payment, the pain doesn't actually double. It increases just by a bit. In fact, the biggest increase in the pain of paying comes when we switch from paying nothing to paying something. Now it's easy to see why one person should pay the entire bill. How so? Well, if every person paid their share, they would all experience some pain of paying. But if only one person paid the entire bill, then the pain of paying for that person will not be that much higher than if he paid just for himself. Let's say it would only be 1.5 times as much. Meanwhile, everyone else at the table is pain-free. Is this system financially efficient? Probably not, because different meals cost different amounts, or the person whose turn it is may be out of town. But even if you end up paying a bit more in the long run for engaging in this practice, you are likely to experience less pain of paying and have more fun dining out with your friends.
Dan Ariely is a professor of behavioral economics at MIT. His most recent book is called Predictably Irrational. Do me a favor and don't make us guess. You can tell us what you're thinking through our website. The homepage is marketplace.org. Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. You got some analysis to do today, my friend.
All right. Is it all over?
Yeah. Come on out from under that desk, you wuss.
Okay. All right.
Come on. Explain yourself, sir.
Gosh. You're not going to like it, but we're going to come back to the same conclusion, which is this is a bear market, and they're going to look for excuses to sell, and there were plenty of them. you had Iran and Israel and oil zooming and then financial crisis after financial crisis and, you know, whether Lehman's going to go under or Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae are going to be taken over by the government and they're going to put little branch offices in the Congress.
Doesn't it seem sort of wrenching, though? I mean, not too long ago, we were cruising along and everything was fine, and bam, now we're down under 11,000 at one point today.
Well, yeah, but more than that is the misery index, I guess, and it's going up. And I actually got a few calls this week saying, somebody said that they were going to the bank and taking all their money out.
Oh, yeah. See, we don't need that kind of talk, right?
And keeping it, that's the ridiculous point. And I had a guy call and wanted to buy Canadian CDs. I've never had that call before. I thought maybe they were giving like a set of dinner glasses, you know, with the CDs. Like,
give me a gut check here, though. I mean, you know, Dow 11,000, while it might seem grim, not terribly bad. Mr. Bernanke said today, or at least there are rumors that he said, you know, we're going to take care of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I mean, what's your real bottom line David Johnson sense of this?
Well, it's just spooky out there. I my sense is that, and having been through this, unfortunately, you know, too many times, you know, my sense is we're going to pull this one out. We always have. And something always comes out of the blue and just, you know, say, well, gosh, God, why didn't I think of that? And the thing just turns around. It just doesn't. This is a bear market. They keep finding people to blame. You know, speaking of people to blame, did you see this letter that was sent out? The one was sent me from Northwest Airlines.
Oh, the airline letter. Yeah.
You guys were talking about this yesterday. Uh-huh. You know, you got to help us out. It's, you know, stop oil speculation now. The thing that intrigued me, it was a two-page letter, and I turned over to the back to see who signed it.
Yeah.
Did you see who signed it?
Actually, no.
No, there was the CEOs of all of the major airlines, American,
right.
Hawaiian, Northwest, US Air, United, Midwest, Delta, Alaska, AirTran, Continental, JetBlue, and Southwest. You know the common thread?
They fly planes? I don't know.
Some of the biggest speculators I've seen.
Oh, yeah, right?
Well, they are. I mean, Gary Kelly has very successfully hedged fuel prices for Southwest Airlines, and they did it on the futures market.
So it's little pot calling the kettle black here. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think we just, you know, we look for people to blame when times are tough.
All right. You know who I'm going to blame?
Who's that?
You.
Oh, yeah. Typical. Yeah. That's it. Right. Shoot the messenger.
David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
But when the times are good, am I going to get any laurels?
You're always my favorite when the times are good.
Yeah,
coming up, a 9-to-5 job that lets you hang 10.
Look at my office. Sunny, wet, never get grouchy people. They're always smiling.
But first, let's do the numbers. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac made for a bumpy ride today. The Dow Industrials dropped 128 points, 1.1% to close at 11,100. The Nasdaq fell 18 points, 0.8%, 22.39 at the bell. The S&P 500 lost 13 points, 1.1%, finished at 12.39. For the week that was, the Dow finished under the weather by 1.7%. The Nasdaq sneezed away 0.3%. The S&P 500 coughed up 1.9%. Fannie Mae gave up more than 22% today after all was said and done. Its cousin Freddie Mac trimmed more than 3% after losing more than half of its value at the early part of the day. All overseas markets fell. The 10-year T-note skidded. The yield rose to 3.96%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Brand Week, the news organization dedicated to the information needs of strategic-minded marketing executives with real-time coverage. Now searchable at brandweek.com. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at events coming up Monday. The AARP holds a forum to discuss the presidential candidate's economic policies. Ernst & Young releases a report on retirement savings for new retirees. The report reveals many Americans will outlive their nest eggs. And Vive la France! France celebrates the storming of the Bastille prison that sparked a revolution in 1789. Happy Bastille Day! I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is iPhone Day, everybody. Unless you've been living under a rock, the new iPhone 3G went on sale this morning, which is all well and good. But half the hoopla about the new phone isn't really about the phone at all. It's about Apple letting users download third-party applications for it. That is, software the company didn't make. Those applications, apps for those in the know, have really taken off in the past year, thanks in part to social networking giants Facebook and MySpace opening themselves up to outside developers. Youth Radio's Ankita Bardwaj explains what the app craze is all about.
My friend Catelyn Gray sure has some caring pals.
Gifts I've gotten lately have been a pair of red stiletto heels, a bowl of Vietnamese noodles, and a panda.
Of course, these aren't real gifts. Catelyn received these presents virtually via Facebook applications. They're kind of like accessories you add on to your Facebook profile to jazzify your page and interact with friends in unexpected ways.
There's my profile picture, which is...
That's my friend Nico Savage. He's got like 12 apps on his profile page, and they're not all about gift-giving. There's an application that lets you play virtual Scrabble.
Here's one of my applications.
Another one lets Nico rate movies and see how his tastes compare with friends, including me.
How could you not like Ace Ventura, Pet Detective?
Because Jim Carrey gets under my skin.
He is a genius. How could you not
like... You see how this conversation evolved? That's pretty much the point of apps like this one. Well, according to Brett Kynes, anyway. Kynes took a whole class on Facebook apps at Stanford last fall. He and some classmates created one that lets you chuck snowballs at your friends.
Me throwing a snowball at you, I could be flirting with you, I could be mad at you, I could be, you know, just saying hi. Even though it's virtual, is not a trivial thing. There's a lot of meaning in that snowball.
The most popular applications make people want to spend more time on sites like Facebook. That's why the company let outside developers tinker with their code. Facebook VP Chamath Palihapitiya says it's lured in 250,000 app developers.
We were never going to build everything for our users because it's just not possible. It's not possible from a practical sense, you know, to hire 250,000 people.
So instead, Facebook acts as a small business incubator for developers who try to make money by placing ads on their applications. Kynes, you know the snowball guy? He launched an app company with Stanford classmate Dan Ackerman Greenberg. Soon after their business took off, Greenberg put in a little phone call to his dad.
And I said, hey, Dad, I'm, you know, having so much trouble juggling school and this business we're running. And he basically said to me, if you don't drop out of school tomorrow, you're going to regret it for the next 30 years. And it's kind of silly to say that I dropped out of school because I built an application called Hugs.
Greenberg's app lets me send a picture of a fuzzy creature of indeterminate species to all my online buddies with a caption, awkward hug from Ankita.
Hugs are very nice. It's fine and it's terrific.
That's Kara Swisher from the Wall Street Journal website, All Things D.
But it's not a business that's sustainable, and that's really what we're talking about here.
Some critics take a look at all this enthusiasm about apps and flash back to the first dot-com bubble, especially with high-flying valuations like $550 million for one app company called Slide. But developers who've struck a chord with their apps are making hundreds of thousands of dollars through advertising. For lots of young techies, that's reason enough to keep pulling all-nighters and cranking out code. In Oakland, I'm Ankita Bardwaj for Marketplace.
Ankita's story was produced for us by Youth Radio. If you live where the temperature's soaring, the beach probably sounds pretty good right about now. So it's a good thing it's time for our summer series, Hot Jobs.
We're having a heat wave.
There are plenty of things to do at the seaside. You can go for a swim, play some volleyball, build a couple of sandcastles. Or you could be real adventurous and take a surfing lesson. You can find classes in a lot of coastal cities around this country. But we went to the birthplace of modern-day surfing, Waikiki, Hawaii, to find our instructor.
This is not a job, it's a lifestyle. I'm Michael, last name Sison. call me Captain Mike. I keep surfing. I take people out in the water, paddle them around, catch them on a couple of waves. A beach boy is someone who goes out there and tries to take care of the customers and doesn't think of the money, because it comes automatically. If you take care of people, they will take care of you. I was 5 years old when I started here on the beach. We'd be here at 3 o'clock in the morning, cleaning the beach before school. Then you go off to school and you come back and you gotta open the stand in the morning and then you close the stand at night. It's a long day. And you did it 7 days a week. When I'm ready to go, I just say, come up here, grab the board, tuck it under your arm, take the board into the water, take it straight into the water. When you're waist high, set the board down and I have you get on the board and we just go. I think standing is not the hardest part of surfing. I think the hardest part is actually catching the wave. The paddling is the hardest part. If you don't quit, I will get you up if it kills us all. And here, I think you get a lot of people who it's their dream to come surfing. And they're so ecstatic when they stand up. I mean, they love it. They just ride that wave. They hoot and holler, make a lot of noise, get excited. I mean, everything, you know? It's a good place to be. It's a good feeling when you have your people stand up and ride those waves. When you look at the person after you're done, and they're smiling and they're happy, and they run up to you and give you a big hug, and they go, man, that was the best time I ever had in my life. I mean, how can you replace that? Never in your lifetime, I don't think that you can ever replace someone telling you that.
Hawaii Public Radio's Noe Tanegawa helped us out with that piece. You can see what Captain Mike looks like at our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, a confirmation that nobody escapes macroeconomic realities. I'll set it up by saying the dollar lost ground against the euro today. It's about $1.60 to the single currency, a little bit shy of that. The falling greenback has gotten the attention of accountants at the Vatican, it seems. The Holy See announced this week that unfavorable exchange rates left it more than $14 million in the red last year. And that is Marketplace on this Friday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 128 points, 1.1%. The Nasdaq shook off 18 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 dipped 13 points, that's 1.1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is a guy named J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday and for the rest of next week, more coverage of the crisis at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And we want to do it with your help. If you're in the process of buying a home, or even if you're just thinking about it, tell us at marketplace.org. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.